Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Welcome. You're tuning into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. Hey, Tim, how are you today?
Doing good. How are you?
Good. A little sad. Another weekend's coming to an end. They come and go just way too quickly nowadays, my friend.
That they do. Yeah, that they do.
You know, I was going through looking over the topics that we've covered here in the last year, and I was reminded that, we lost a friend of ours, Guy Lyon Playfair, a little over a year ago, and we did a special replay edition of the episode that we had him on for, talking about the Enfield poltergeist case.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually did that interview leading up to the release of the Conjuring movie, the last Conjuring film. And, you know, it was really an interesting interview. We got some fascinating insights into the story. And, you know, talking to Guy Lyon Playfair, I always kind of felt like we got pretty much the definitive story regarding the case. The Conjuring movie came out, more questions arose from that. And he was kind enough during our interview to address the information regarding Ed and Lorraine Warren's involvement in the case, or at least his understanding of the involvement in the case. And now that Ed and Lorraine are gone, I kind of felt like our chasing of the Enfield poltergeist story was pretty much done. I don't know where else we could possibly go. And then I was contacted by one of the publishers we work very closely with. And there's a brand new book. It's called The Enfield Poltergeist Tapes, One of the Most Disturbing Cases in History, What Really Happened. And Dr. Melvin Willen is the author of this book. And Tim, I got to tell you, I love when there's honesty right up front from authors.
Okay.
And in reading the description online through Amazon, it starts with, "Do not buy this book if you want to read a biased account of the famous Enfield poltergeist case from 1977 through 1978. There are many choices you could make which will either try to convince you of the genuineness of the phenomena produced or its fraudulent origins according to the interpretation of the authors concerned. I do not mind whether you have a wide open mind or a totally shut one, since I shall not be trying to convince you one way or another. Do buy this book if you want to know what really happened." So I love that the account, just in the selling of the book, tells you up front that this is coming in off of a strictly factual line of information. So let's welcome to the show Dr. Melvin Willen. Dr. Willen, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Okay, that's a pleasure, and thank you for that introduction.
You know, it's an interesting take. And, you know, there are some cases, you know, we've beat Amityville pretty much into the ground. I don't think there's an aspect of it we haven't covered over 13 years. And the Enfield poltergeist has been brought up two or three times on our show. But this, I love the version that you put forth. And this isn't somebody trying to prove their life's research and studies. This isn't somebody trying to prove that their house was haunted or cash in on either one of these sides of the storyline. So let me ask you, first of all, how did you get involved in the story yourself?
Well, I was very friendly with both Maurice Gross and Guy Playfair, who were obviously the main two investigators of the case. And when Maurice died, which was about 10 years ago, he said to me before he died that he would like me to have custodianship of all the tapes he'd made during the course of their investigation. Now, I duly took on board those tapes and started listening to them and thought that many of them were deteriorating strongly, so they ought to be digitalized and brought up to date and also transcribed. So I started doing that and had just about finished doing it when, alas, Guy Playfair died, which, as you said, was about a year and a month ago or so. And he did exactly the same. He left his tapes to the SPR, Society for Psychical Research. And so I did the same with them and thought, wow, there's so much material here, hundreds and hundreds of hours of taping, much of which hasn't seen the light of day. So let's make a list, more or less, of what's on those tapes and say to people, well, this is what was recorded. Now you decide whether you think the origin of it was paranormal or girls mucking about or whatever other aspect you want to pick up on.
Now, you're very honest, as I said, even in the description, and you do mention that you've listed and transcribed all of the several hundred audio tapes that were made by Morris Gross and Guy Playfair during the investigation of this alleged poltergeist case that took place now, what, a little over 40 years ago.
Yep.
You did make the decision not to involve parts of it that just really had no import to the story. And to delineate that line, you're talking about, oh, it's a lovely day today, or, you know, wow, this rain is really bringing me down. Hey, did you see the special going on down the street at the sale? And so you eliminate all of the kind of the frivolous banter, and you stick with just the story and the facts of this story. So when reading it, it's not filled with a lot of fluff and non-important content.
That's true. I mean, the only time I mention any of the things that you just mentioned are if they are relevant to the case. So if there was a thunderstorm going on and then something went flying across the room, well, one might mention there was a thunderstorm because a flash of lightning or thunder might have dislodged something that was standing on the edge of a bookcase or something.
Right, right. Something that was relevant, as you said, to the case.
Absolutely, yes.
What was your perception of this case before you began listening to these tapes and transcribing them?
Well, like so many people, without knowing anything about it, I had a firm opinion that it was all a load of rubbish, because that's what people do. They have a firm opinion one way or the other before they actually know a great deal about what's going on. So I thought that, yes, they were taken for a ride, lovely men, both of them, but they were taken for a ride and that was the end of it. But then, of course, I started listening to the tapes and I started to research it and I started to talk to lots and lots of people. And I thought, well, hang on here, it's me that's being stupid. So I decided to go into it in depth and I changed my mind to quite an extent.
Well, let's start off, if it's okay with you, could you give a bit for our listeners that may not have heard our previous interviews or have taken a look at the movie The Conjuring Part 2, The Enfield Poltergeist? Hmm. Could you give us a brief synopsis of this story?
Okay, yes. In August of 1977, the Hodgson family were sort of living in Enfield in a council house. They were not particularly wealthy, but they were getting on with their lives. And a couple of the kids went up to bed and some banging sounds were heard. So the mother thought, oh, the girls are just mucking about. So she went up to sort of admonish them. And lo and behold, something happened in front of her. A piece of furniture moved of its own accord. And the mother thought, oh my God, something's going on here. So they went out, they went to the neighbors next door, and things started to happen in the house, which increased over the subsequent weeks and months, and as it turned out, over a year, with activities, things flying around, loads of people visiting, some skeptical, some believers, people witnessing things, recording things, taking photographs of things. There's a huge list of the number of different types of phenomena that occurred during the course of these investigations. A lot of people dwell on Janet and Margaret. By the way, both of the girls had these strange voices, these guttural voices. a lot of people dwell on that. But to be honest, I think the poltergeist activity, the movement of objects, which could then be witnessed and recorded, was far more important than the two of them talking in funny voices.
And the amount of activity that took place in this house, the reported, I should say, amount of activity that took place in this house, can you give us kind of a little broad stroke again of exactly what type of things were known to occur?
Well, objects flew around. Think of an object, and there's a very good chance that it flew around at some stage or the other, measured in hundreds, really. So things from the bathroom, things from the toilet, things from the kitchen, things from the bedroom, the dining room, outside, all sorts of different types of things, large pieces of furniture, small pieces of, say, Lego or cuddly toys and things like that. Just about anything you can think of that exists in a house got hurled around at different times. Now, that's one thing. Then the girls themselves, in particular Janet, was often thrown out of bed on the floor. Some people said that she levitated into the air, and that was witnessed by people. So we have activity centering on the actual people. The neighbours, of course, and Mrs. Hodgson, her brother, also witnessed a lot of these different things. Then there was apparitional activity. So they saw, well, they believe they saw some apparitions at times, sort of shadow-like figures moving around. And then there were terrible dreams that they would have where they would seem, a couple of them would simultaneously be dreaming something. And the dreams were quite upsetting for them. So we have that as well. The investigators got pelted with things at different times. Poor old Morris got bashed on the head by a cardboard box when he was in the room in daylight. So that's just a sprinkling of some of the things that happened.
And these accounts, were they ever taking place directly in front of, and I know you just mentioned one to Morris Gross, but did they ever happen in front of Guy Playfair or Morris Gross, or was most of this secondhand tellings of these stories?
No, it happened in front of them and in front of other people on a multitude of times. We're not talking about a one-off here at all.
All right. Now, in breaking down these cassettes, one thing I want to just see if you can address at any point, was there any involvement that you're aware of the legendary ghost hunting duo Ed and Lorraine Warren? Is there any mention of them through any of the research that you did?
Yes, very little. They evidently turned up twice. Once was unannounced. We have a recording of them on one of these occasions when I think it was Guy was there at the time, and they spent quite a bit of time. It's a very confused recording because I think it was Lorraine spent a lot of time on the telephone to somebody trying to sort out some sort of deal that was going on concerning copyrighting their activity there. So you've kind of got multiple conversations going on. On the other occasion that they turned up,
Wait one second, if we could. Let's just review that aspect of this.
Yep.
So instead of just being there on the basis of being there to investigate these claims, she spends most of the time trying to deal with copyright issues over the interview that they're about to do, and if this story is going to belong to them?
That's what the recording recalled, or recorded, I should say. It wasn't a very long recording because I don't know whether Guy got bored with this or whether they asked him to turn the machine off. But there was certainly a phone conversation going on with a reporter or a producer. I think it was a producer, actually. I could look it up in my notes. Whereby the conversation was geared around producing a program or producing copyright on the interviews rather than the actual investigation itself. That was the one that's on record. Now, there's a second time when they came, which is not on the tapes, but it was written up by Guy Playfair. And in that, he said that the family were very upset by the appearance of the Warrens out of the blue. They further really mucked things up a bit by taking out the girls to a Wimpy Bar, which is like a sort of a burger joint, but didn't take out the boys because there were two girls and two boys in the family, but they wanted to concentrate on the girls. And so that caused a bit of upset, as you can imagine. So all in all, they weren't very popular while they were there.
And those were the two instances,
yes,
that we know of, or at least were recorded during the time.
Absolutely. One was recorded on tape, as I said, and the other one was written down by Guy.
But the recording on tape was really not even them talking to the family or dealing with the children. They were more dealing with the legalities of the story that they were hoping to sell.
That is correct.
Interesting. Thank you for that.
That's okay. I'm just actually, since you've mentioned it, I'm just going into my computer to see if I can find the actual bit of footage that was there. I'm not going to play it over for you, but if I can find out exactly what was being said, perhaps if you come back to that, I'll have found it by then.
Okay, well, certainly if you find it during that time, we'll revisit that at the end of the interview. Sure. Now, these tapes, do they exist in a way that they can be heard by fellow investigators and researchers around the world, or is this something that's held in private now through the Society for Psychical Research?
Yeah. Well, the Society for Psychical Research has the copyright on those tapes, and they've been transcribed by me, so therefore they are available if the SPR decides they want to make them generally available. Now, that means that it will go to a committee, and in due course they will make a decision on that. I think what they're probably waiting for is to sort of get a meeting together whereby they can combine both Morris's and Guy's, because Morris's were done some time ago, but Guy's were only finished like about a year or so ago, and probably slightly less than that. So therefore, they're probably waiting until they've got the whole package together so that they can then decide about whether to make them available for members only or for the public at large, and those sort of issues that they will decide on, not me.
Can you tell me, in reviewing the cassettes and the accounts of what took place, you know, many of the dramatizations make Morris Gross seem much more closely related to the family, and that he was there for much of the beginning of this story. What can you tell us regarding that aspect of this history as well?
Yeah, well, he wasn't involved at all at the very beginning of it, which is why we have no tape recordings of the first few days of activity, because the press were called in, the police were called in. They witnessed things and thought, wow, something's going on here. Let's contact the SPR. The SPR was duly contacted. And because Morris was a relatively new member and was interested in doing a case, he lived in London, so he could get there relatively easily. He was advised to see what he'd make of it. So he went along, and things happened to him. So he then pleaded with the SPR to have somebody else to join him. You know, the more the merrier, because he wanted to sort of do the investigation properly. And so then he became increasingly involved, as did Guy Playfair, and to a lesser extent, an awful lot of other members of the SPR and other organizations.
And having that many people come through there, were there many members that were not as excited about what was taking place?
Indeed, yes. You know, you have two camps, don't you? You have the people that came along and thought, wow, this is really quite something. This could turn into one of the best cases of all time. And other people saying, oh, nothing happened when I was there. Or, no, I just saw one of the girls falling about, so there was nothing to it. The big problem was people would go for two or three hours on one occasion and then make their mind up, whereas Guy and Morris were there for hundreds of hours. So they had rather more information at their disposal than just a quick visit and a quick idea about what was happening.
Now, you yourself said that you came into it with the preconceived notion that this was nothing more than a rubbish and a couple of men that had been played very well.
Yep.
How soon into the actual recordings did things start to change in the way that you looked at this case?
Yeah. Well, it was slowly but surely. I thought, I'm doing these recordings, so it's not my job to judge anything. I'm just relating what's down on the recordings. But increasingly, the way that people were reacting in those recordings made me think, no, they're not just fooling around. They are genuinely scared about some of the things that were happening. And I just didn't, I couldn't believe any longer that the girls in particular were managing to fool so many different types of people all the time. I just thought this is beyond my boggle factor, if you like, that they could be getting away with this.
And the actual things that were caught on recording, what were some of the very first instances that you can recall?
Well, there was obviously times when there was lots of screaming going on because things were happening. People were being thrown out of bed. Objects were flying through the air, all of that sort of thing. There was one in particular with Morris when he was talking to the entity, if you like, and said, "Are you having a game with me?" And at this point on the tape, I mean, you hear him saying this, of course, and then you hear this whooshing sound, and it sounds like something that's being sort of slid along a surface and then flying through the air. And then he yells out, and somebody else screams, and somebody else says, "Oh, blimey," and so on. As a box of toys hits him on the head. And this was, as I say, in daylight and in front of several other people. And there was no way that this box of toys could have been picked up. It was out of the way of where the girls were. So they'd have had to have moved to have got to it. They'd have had to have then lifted it up and then thrown it across the room. So that was a pretty impressive bit of tape.
Did you have any video that you were able to review of these instances as well, or are you simply going straight off of audio?
The unfortunate thing was that there was very little video made at the time. Subsequently, we don't know where it is. It was made by Pi, which is quite a well-known recording company, or they were at the time anyway. I don't know if they still are now. And evidently, it was inconclusive what the video recordings made. So it seemed that the entities, the forces, whatever words you want to use, did not like to operate in terms of video. So I haven't seen any video other than what people recorded for TV companies when they were interviewing everybody concerned. So, I mean, we have the voices being done on video. You can see Janet using her voice and speaking on video. That's in the public domain. But we don't have any extra video. Well, at least I don't have any extra video. So that's a rather long-winded reply to your question. So everything that I based my research on was on audio and not on video.
All right. I just, for clarification, wanted to cross that off the line here. So unfortunately, although the audio is dramatic and certainly interesting to hear, it, again, is only audio, so it's painting more of a theater of the mind than it is actually allowing you to corroborate any of this evidence.
Yes. I mean, you hear what's going on. You hear the reactions to the people concerned. You hear things moving around. You hear the clutter and the clatter. You hear all of this. You hear people saying what has happened or what is happening, and then it's up to you as an individual whether you believe that or not, or whether you think everybody is lying, or that indeed the spirits are chucking things around. You know, that's the choice that everybody has to make individually.
Now, in these aspects, what did you find to be the most compelling parts of the story that you uncovered in revealing these hundreds of hours of audio?
I don't think it was so much specific things. It was more the quantity of things that were going on, that there wasn't sort of one major incident where you can say, well, that is it. I've just heard this thing whoosh through the air, make a clonk, everybody's yelling, so that must be the one. It was more a case of time and time again. You put a tape on, it's a 90-minute tape, and for about an hour's worth of that 90 minutes, there's all hell breaking loose with things firing off in all directions. And you think they're going through this day after day after day. I don't believe that they wanted to do it just for a bit of fun, because everybody was getting exhausted. Sometimes they were getting clobbered by bits of things. One of the photographers, Graham Morris, got whacked by a bit of Lego, and other people had things thrown at them. I mean, nobody was badly damaged. But if I was being thrown out of bed sort of half a dozen times in the space of half an hour, I think I'd get a bit fed up with it.
Were there ever times that the recording would go on that perhaps the girls or one of the family members was unaware that they were being recorded?
Yes. Yes. And, go on.
That's what I was curious about is what can you tell me about those moments? And were you able to, what was there anything specifically revealing about that aspect of the story? Because so much has been said of did they fake it? Did they not? What really took place? So I'd like you to cover that. But first, let me mention 60 seconds. That's exactly how long this commercial lasts. You know what else you can do in about a minute? Well, you can get an offer for your car with TrueCar. That's right. In the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, do a few sit-ups, or just listen to my voice, you can get a true cash offer. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or home. Just go to TrueCar and simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up. Answer a few questions and you'll get an accurate true cash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in and they'll check it out with you together. You can ask questions and get the answers you need. That way, there's never any surprises. Then simply leave with your check or trade in your car for a new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. We're discussing the new book, The Enfield Poltergeist Tapes, one of the most disturbing cases in history. What really happened? The author of this book, Dr. Melvin Willen, is our guest. Now, the question I posed before the break was, in the recording, was there ever any time that the girls, the two main girls that were the focal point of this story, or their family, were ever recorded without their knowledge? And in those moments, Dr. Willen, how revealing was that to aspects of the reality of the story?
Well, it's kind of difficult when it's only audio, as you can understand, but there was one occasion where Guy left his machine on by mistake, and you can hear activity, you can hear the bed creaking, it was in the bedroom, and then clunking as Janet got hurled out, or Margaret, I can't remember off the top of my head, and then lots of laughter. Now, you might think, well, if they were just doing that for a bit of fun, and if they'd have known the machine was on, perhaps they wouldn't have done it. There were other occasions when you hear voices very close to the machine, and you hear sort of things that might be saying, oh, you know, the machine's on, oh dear, that sort of thing. So I'm pretty convinced, and so was Guy and so was Morris, that they did actually fake some of the phenomena. So, I mean, a couple of children, in fact, four children, they're bound to be getting up to tricks and fooling people at certain times. But I think the question you have to ask yourself is, did they do it all the time in circumstances which it would have been almost impossible to have done? There were examples of things going missing, dematerializations, if you like, where, I mean, I don't know how they could have done that, and the various magicians that they brought along didn't know how they could have done it. So, you know, one has to say, well, they certainly faked some of the things. They admitted to it. They said that, yes, when they faked things and Guy and or Morris caught them out. But did they do it all the time? Most certainly not.
When they faked things, do you believe that it was ever because they were being, I don't want to say pressured in the sense like they had to have something happen, but because there were such high expectations from the visitors that would come through? And maybe again, you can help me with this so we understand the amount of visitors that came through during that year and a half. As my understanding is, not only did they have researchers, scientists, newspaper, television, but they also had celebrities, musicians, actors, sports athletes that would come through and visit. They were on showcase through most of this.
Yes, to some extent. I'm not sure to quite the extent that you're indicating there. I mean, celebrities, well, what is a celebrity? They did have Matthew Manning who came along, and Matthew Manning was at the time quite well known for his own poltergeist activity when he was a child. When he came along, he was a young man, an adult. And he'd been on television a lot and appeared with Uri Geller in due course. But whether that quite makes him a celebrity or not, I'm not so sure. But apart from that, certainly on the tapes, there aren't any sort of the big pop stars or sports people that we might call celebrities now. They weren't recorded, and they weren't recorded in writing either. So I don't think there were big, big names appearing there. As to the other thing that you said, I'm pretty sure, yes, that they were at times wanting to keep things going because it was a fun time for them, as well as being an extremely difficult time for them. So I think that that's why some of the times they produced things, because if nothing was happening and you've got half a dozen people that have turned up and they're expecting things to happen and they have a chance to make it happen, well, perhaps they did that now and then.
Were there moments during this where Morris or even Guy questioned their safety? Should they continue there? Should they move on? Or were they always interested in trying to help this family and uncover the reason for this?
No, they were very, very concerned about the state of the family. Morris in particular became almost a sort of a father figure, because there was no father there. He turned up once a week with maintenance payments for them. But he wasn't he had left the family home about a year or two beforehand. And Morris was very concerned for the children and the mother and the whole family. And they didn't want anything to happen that was going to cause them any grief. So, I mean, in some ways, it would have been easier if Morris had been a lot harder on them. And because he might well then have not had their safety as his main concern, which he always did. I mean, him and Guy were very good like that. It was the people first and the investigation second, albeit a close second.
When these two intrepid investigators are pushing through this case through hundreds of hours, were they being scrutinized by other members of the Association of Cyclical Research? And how was that? You know, it almost seems, in some of the interpretations I've read, some of the different versions, that even within their own organization, they were kind of looked at as maybe not the most reliable researchers or sources, and then others hold them in very high esteem. Was there a general consensus, or was there always kind of contention, as there is in the current state of the paranormal field? Even though we're all looking for the same thing, nobody wants to believe one another.
There was a big mixture. There was a committee set up by the SPR to actually investigate not just the case, but the investigators. And that committee had good things to say about them. It also had less good things to say because, again, they only went a few times, so they didn't have the amount, the quantity of experiences that Guy and Morris had had. Despite that, some of the people that went there thought that it was definitely a case to be looked at and there was probably genuine activity going on, and other people said that they didn't think there was. This is within the investigating people. So there was a big mixture. They didn't have a sort of easy time, a blanket time of, yes, we think everything is wonderful, you go ahead and carry on doing it. People were scrutinizing the way that they were doing the investigation all the way through it.
The vocalizations obviously are going to be some of the most dramatic aspects, and it's some of the most highly debated, because the claims were that these children could speak in these voices for hours without it having any long-term effect or impact on their normal speaking voices. One aspect, you know, growing up, I was a huge fan of the Our Gang comedies and the Little Rascals, and they had a character named Froggy who spoke like that, with that gravelly voice and doing that. And as kids, we could talk like that for long periods of time when we would be playing, and it never caused any long-term effect. But it was such, you know, in speaking with Guy and some of the other people involved in this case, they adhere to that fact that they believe that it really would have caused severe damage to the vocal cords. Was there any medical testing done on that at all?
Yes, there was. And they believed it wasn't the vocal cords, but it was the false cords. There's a Latin name for that, which I can't remember. And that it would have damaged those if they'd have maintained it for hour upon hour. But the thing is, though, that this is where there was a bit of misunderstanding, which you're aware of if you listen to the tapes, because they didn't just continuously talk hour after hour. There'd be a few sentences, then there'd be a gap. There'd be a few sentences, then there'd be a gap. So it wasn't continuous talk. And both the girls did actually complain occasionally about having a sore throat. That's not normally mentioned. You know, people say, oh, they could speak for hours and hours and not have a sore throat. Well, it wasn't continuous talking for hours and hours. And occasionally they did have sore throats because it was admitted to on the tapes. I've heard it being said.
Well, that shines a whole new light on this. Why do you feel then that, you know, that Morris and Guy were so steadfast in the fact that they didn't believe that the girls were faking that and would lend credibility and credence to that fact? Yet in the recordings themselves, the girls complain about their throats hurting and there wasn't continued conversation for hours.
Well, Morris often said, and he didn't say that they were talking continuously for hour upon hour. He would say that they talked during that period, but he wouldn't say continuously. That's the first point. And the other point is that, okay, he may have forgotten that they occasionally said they'd got a bit of a sore throat, but considering the amount of times that they did speak with that voice, which was over several months, one would have thought that they might have done a bit more damage to their voices, possibly, if they had been just sort of, you know, corrupting their voices to put on those talks. The interesting thing was that they also said that the voice, as far as they were concerned, this is the girls, came from the back of their head, not the throat, which is interesting in itself. They did some experiments with laryngographs and things like that to sort of test that, and they found that the voices were in a strange sort of way coming from the back of them rather than from just the front in the normal way. So that was slightly odd.
Well, I want to discuss that a little bit more, and you know, the way that it's been represented, some of the tests that they've done, and my understanding. We'll do that when we return. First, we've got to talk about this right here on Beyond the Darkness.
Coming soon to Podcast One, the Gigi Podcast with Rick Fox, Jace Hall, and Todd Roy. Log on to see the world behind the esports you love and find out what good game really means from the trio who's taken the business by storm, including the three-time NBA champion behind Team Echo Fox. Download new episodes of the Gigi Podcast every week on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back to the program. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. You can join Tim and I here every Saturday and Sunday for Beyond the Darkness. And remember to check me out every Monday through Friday on Midnight in the Desert. You get 7 days a week of the best of anomalous and paranormal talk radio. You can get all that information right off of our app. If you are a Droid user, make sure to get our free app, Darkness Radio. You can take all the shows with you on the road, listen to them anytime, any place, anywhere, and it gives you subscription options for Midnight in the Desert or to listen to the live feature. It gives you subscription features for our True Crime Tuesday program, and of course, our Saturday and Sunday Beyond the Darkness programs are always available through that app as well. Or just go straight to darknessradio.com to get even more information about all of the programs. The Enfield Poltergeist tapes, one of the most disturbing cases in history. What really happened? Dr. Melvin Willen, our guest. Dr. Willen, we were talking before the break about the voices and the girls that would project these voices. In some of the cases, and you know, the way it was represented in the Conjuring movie, and in some of the interviews I've heard, they would actually place either tape over the girls' mouths or have the girls hold a mouthful of water while this voice would come out. Is there any truth to that, or again, was that Hollywood creations?
Okay, excuse me. Well, they did attempt, Morris and Guy attempted to place tape with the girls and the mother's permission over their mouths while they had a mouthful of water, Janet in particular. It was very, very inconclusive as far as one can hear on the tape, because often you Morris would complain and say, oh, no, Janet, don't spit the water out. You've got to keep it in your mouth while you then do the voice. Or she would only be able to sort of mutter a few sort of indistinct grunts virtually. And some people said, oh, no, that's marvelous. We can actually hear talking while her mouth is taped and the water is in the mouth. But on the tapes, you can't really hear that very well. You can hear some sounds coming out of them, but they're not as good as I would have hoped them to be.
So it was not nearly as clear, and the projection was not happening outside of the girls. It was emanating from within them.
Yes, absolutely. I don't think anybody said, well, they may have done, but that's down to them. As far as the tapes are concerned, you can hear that the voices are coming from the girls, Janet in particular. And when she is using the voice without her mouth having something taped over it or anything, you see her lips moving. They're moving in a strange sort of way. She's not sort of enunciating as you or I might enunciate, but nevertheless, her mouth is moving. She quite often put her hand sort of close to her mouth when she was talking, which is a little bit strange, but I don't think she was trying to disguise that she was actually producing the voice. Now, whether she was being forced to use that voice, that's a wholly different matter of opinion, because you could argue very easily, I think, that a lot of her actions were sort of happening without her particularly wanting them to happen. She was almost being forced, if you like, into speaking as she did, which was pretty badly at times, and doing some of the things that she did, which were quite unpleasant for her at times.
The reason I ask is, and I'm trying to remember, there was a news reporter and I believe the photographer from the Conjuring case that we had on our show, and also had on Coast to Coast AM as my guests. And they talked about the fact that the sound would actually come from behind the girls.
Yep. Yes, I mentioned that earlier, that
right.
It came sort of from their neck, if you like. And that was rather strange. When they fitted the odd device onto them, it seemed that the sound was coming from the rear of their head rather than the front of their head. But the tape recorder, of course, wouldn't pick that up. You've got a tape recorder recording this, and it's just recording the sound. This is Guy's and Morris's tape recorders.
Right. And the different tests they did, though, as you said, made it more inconclusive. Do you believe that then it wasn't necessarily proving that the voices weren't coming from them, but it wasn't as if there was a spirit outside of them doing the speaking?
No, I wouldn't say that it sounded as if there was a spirit outside of them speaking. I would say that it was coming, the voices that were coming through were coming from them. It was using their body as a battery or as a channel. But whether they were intentionally faking those voices or not, now that's a different story altogether.
If you don't mind me asking, in your opinion, what do you think was going on with that?
What, with the voices?
Yes.
Well, I don't want to use the word possession because it's such a loaded word that people immediately think of The Exorcist or other such things. But I do think that they were being compelled at times to actually use voices and to say things which they didn't want to say but somehow were coming out through their mouths.
The reason I ask is there is video footage of the two sisters sitting there being interviewed.
Yep.
And Janet, who I believe was the one that seemed more centered around. Is that correct, Janet?
Yes, absolutely.
She and her sister are sitting there and the voice starts coming out and it's doing that grunting. And the one sister kind of side eyes her sister. And then Janet makes some kind of flippant comment about it being faked, you know, without saying it. And her sister kind of gives her a little smack, like, hey, you know, they're paying attention to what we're saying right now. And I'm sure you're familiar with the footage I'm referring to.
Yes, yes, I am.
Which makes it really call into question their legitimacy at any of this.
On that occasion, it most certainly does, yes. Whether it was like that on every occasion remains to be seen. There's always a difficulty with these things. If you look at some mediums, as in psychic mediums, mm-hmm. that have blatantly cheated at times, and everybody knows they cheated. They probably know they cheated themselves. But one has to ask oneself, but did they actually cheat every time? Now, if they did, then they were fraudulent and fakes, and off they go. But if they did it just on occasions and not every time, then they were still displaying something that's beyond our normal senses, beyond our normal capabilities.
What I'll do now is I've got the audio here. We'll have Tim play that segment real quickly so that the audience can hear what we're discussing.
Great.
Maurice Gross is an electronics engineer and an investigator for the Society for Psychical Research.
Over here was Janet, and over here, in this bed here, was Margaret.
It was in the same bedroom a month later, with all the family present, that Maurice Gross first challenged the poltergeist to talk.
And this was actually the result. You'll hear here the whistling, first of all, and then the barking.
And here is this
The barking here is quite extraordinary, actually.
We've got a dog in here.
I then said to it,
I then, as I said on the tape here, I then said to it, if you can whistle and bark and groan, then you can talk. And I asked it to actually say my name.
Well, just a minute. I'll try again. I want you to call out my name, my complete name, Maurice Gross. See if you can do that. Very good. Let me hear you say my name again. Come on, let me hear you say my name. Come on, my name's Maurice. Let me hear you say it.
Maurice.
Now, that was the first time we heard the voice, and since then we've been hearing it again and again, and it's been getting louder and louder.
These teenage sisters believe they're haunted by a poltergeist.
I was going to ask the same question as I asked earlier. How many voices are there?
600.
600 the voices.
I know the joke.
How many really are there, Margaret?
I think so far we've had 10.
Three.
Sensible voices. But the rest of the names are absolute rubbish.
How does it feel to be haunted by a poltergeist?
It's not haunted.
Shut up.
Why isn't it haunted?
I don't know.
Does it frighten you? The things that happen here.
Oh, well, it did first, but now I've got more used to it. And you learn to accept the things that happen.
Slanger covered it, Mum. My idiot, Mum. Slanger bookshelf at Margaret.
Have you tried telling it to go away?
Yes, many times.
No, nothing.
And what does it reply?
No, it won't.
So there it is. There's the audio that we just talked about, and there is a full video that exists out there. I'll put it on my social media so people can find it and watch the entire video. It's, I think, a 12 or 13 minute video, but that's the segment that I was referring to, where it seems that they're even tiring of this game and attention. And it seemed like almost they were calling themselves out. And I don't know, did you get the feel that sometimes it was, let's just get through this. Let's, you know, we just want this over with. We don't want any more attention from people. Maybe if we get caught, which is kind of the way they portray it in the movie, maybe if we get caught, everyone will just leave us alone and we can move on.
I don't think that was the case. I don't think they wanted to get caught so they could move on. I think that they may have got tired of it, and whether they consciously or subconsciously got tired of it, if they consciously got tired of it, then perhaps they were not bothering to do it so much. And let's not forget that eventually the whole thing more or less fizzled out and stopped happening. But whether they were consciously wanting that to happen or subconsciously, or whether just if there was any genuine paranormality to it, it just ceased. It had blown its course.
Well, let's talk about some of the falsities of the movies. Now, there were two movies, and actually the one that came out in the BBC I really enjoyed. I thought it was really well done. Now, I enjoyed the Conjuring movie as well for just the entertainment value. I think the Conjuring series has been a great throwback to classic ghost stories and horror stories. So I've enjoyed the Conjuring movies. I don't want to belittle that in any way. The Enfield Haunting, the complete series based on the real life events, which was a really compelling mini series that you had over in the UK. And then, of course, The Conjuring 2, and they were separated, I think, by about a year in airing. Would you say either one of them played a little bit closer to the storyline, or were they both pretty far out there from the actual events?
I think The Conjuring was far out. I think the three-part series that was shown in this country was unfortunately also a bit far out, but it was closer. Some of the aspects they more or less got right. They put things in which blatantly didn't happen, and ridiculously they left out some of the things that did happen that they might have used and been fairly dramatic. That when I watched them, I was very surprised at some of the things that were in and some of the things that were out.
It is strange, right? In the cases that Hollywood goes with, sometimes they put in something that's so corny and cliche for a horror movie, and then when you read the real account, there are aspects that were 10 times more terrifying in depth, and they don't even add it. They I don't know if it's they can't figure out a way to convey that. I don't know. I'm baffled by it. It's got to be concerning too, right? You know, why? What do you feel was something that has been left out of these stories that you thought was, wow, now this is legitimately a terrifying moment?
Well, I wouldn't say it was terrifying, but I would say it was very interesting, and that is Janet's alleged levitation. I'm talking about the triptych, the three-part series that was in the UK. They left out completely the fact that she was witnessed by people outside of the house, the lollipop lady, the lady that helps people across the road, children, and a delivery man, I think he was a baker, that saw her rising up on her bed into the air whilst they were stood outside the house. Now, that wasn't in the three-part series, but the three-part series did have CCTV going on, which, of course, there most certainly wasn't.
Right.
So they put that in, which made us all groan when we saw it, and they left out a possible alleged, I have to add, levitation, which would have made good TV or good cinema.
Well, let me ask you about the levitation. Now, there's photographs of Janet allegedly being kind of launched in the air from her bed across the room. Now, to any one of us that were ever a child, it sure as hell looks like she's jumping from one bed to the other in this set of photographs. Now, I don't know if these are just poorly grabbed screen captures of the actual footage or the photographs. How do we explain this? Do you believe that this was a true levitation moment? Where she was being thrown. I mean, her legs are bent up in a way that it looks like she's springing off the bed.
Yes, it does look as if she's doing that. And the footage was caught by a photographer, Graham Morris, and he had a some sort of device that shot off several pictures when there was movement. So he got these shots as best he could when he was not in the room. It was a sort of a device that went off. It looks as if she's leaping in the air. She was a very athletic, gymnastic sort of person. And on that particular occasion that we're talking about via those photos, I would agree with you. I mean, I think it looks as if she's jumping in the air. When she was seen by other people from outside, they said that it didn't look like that, that she was rising up in a more sort of horizontal way. And also, Guy, and remember, Guy was a lot younger at this time, he attempted to get himself lifted up off the bed to see if he could achieve what she was doing. And he said he got nowhere near it. He couldn't possibly spring up. The bed wasn't springy enough to do that. So I think, yeah, it's very difficult. The photos, to me, look as if she's leaping. But that doesn't mean that the hundreds of times that it happened that she wasn't being pulled up into the air in some form or the other.
All right, let's discuss some of the other glaring differences in the stories that have been represented out there. What can you tell us? Obviously, we know that The Conjuring 2 took a lot of liberties for the story itself, but what are some of the glaring instances that just did not happen?
I'm not sure. I hadn't seen The Conjuring 2 for a long time. So I probably need to keep away from that question unless I come and say something that's completely wrong, having forgotten that it was in that film or it wasn't in that film. I mean, I know that as far as other films are concerned, that people have made the accusation that, well, they were just copying something they saw in The Exorcist, for instance, as a prime example. But as far as The Conjuring is concerned, both of the films, I think that some of the things that, for instance, were seen, the apparitions that they saw in Enfield were just fleeting glances of a sort of a black shadow, something like that, whereas I seem to recall there were sort of demonic things going on in The Conjuring.
The apparitions that were seen,
yeah.
Was it something that was seen by the investigators, or was it always just family members?
It was never seen by the investigators. It was seen by the children and by other people, by adults as well. The mother saw what she believed was a partial apparition, and so did her brother, John Burkham. And other people had sensations, but then you would have sensations if you were in a house which you believed to be haunted in some way or the other.
And in this, were there any real injuries that occurred to any of the family members from this type of activity?
There weren't bad injuries requiring hospitalization. I mean, Janet, I believe, did get taken to hospital the next day after a particularly bad incident at night, but it wasn't because of physical injury. It was because she was in just such a state. They did have the doctor around on occasion who prescribed various drugs to try and calm her down. And Morris got fairly battered on one occasion when he was trying to hold Janet down, because she would be throwing hysterical fits on the tapes. One of the most disturbing things is some of the fits that Janet in particular was having when she was totally hysterical, had gained considerable strength. There was two or three people trying to hold her down to stop her hurting herself as she was sort of thrashing around, and they were being hurt and kicked and so on in the process. So there was probably a few bruises and grazes during the course of things, but there were no broken bones. There were no sort of hospitalizations in that respect.
All right. And now you brought up The Exorcist and the popularity of that movie around the same time.
Yeah.
You know, talk to me about the family. I mean, it's always seemed that they were in a pretty bad state financially. I mean, is that something you think they would have even had seen?
I'm not sure whether they'd seen it or not. It was, I think it was about 3 years before when it came out, although don't quote me on that. And I'm not sure whether they would have seen the film, but they may have seen posters for it or something or the other. The problem with The Exorcist was based on a real-life case the so-called Mount Rainier case, which happened in the States in the earlier part of the century, about 1940-something another. And the case was well written up and investigated by people, by the church in particular. And that then led to the film The Exorcist, the book and the film. And there were certain aspects of those two cases which were the same in the Enfield case, but nothing like the extent that the fictional film and book made, and nothing quite like the original Mount Rainier case either.
Do you have any feel, again, in kind of looking over the story now, of, you know, do you believe there was any truly demonic or dark force at play here, or was this more of a true poltergeist type scenario?
Okay, well, this is just my personal opinion, and of course I could be wrong, but I personally don't think there was anything demonic that was going on in this case at all. So I don't think, that's not the way I take these things, and I try and look at it fairly scientifically if I can, and part of my science doesn't embrace demons. But whether it was something psychic going on within the psyche or the minds of the people concerned, now that's a whole different ballgame for me. And I think that that's a possibility. The fact that modern-day science hasn't got to grips with that yet doesn't mean that it will do in due course. Like many other things, it will then become understood better, and it'll just be spoken of as the normal rather than the paranormal.
The haunting itself, Bill, what was his name, Bill?
Yeah, well, he had various names, actually, Bill Wilkins. So he was also referred to as Joe and Fred and all sorts of things.
Were there any actual ties to historical figures? And I don't necessarily mean in the you know, name of historical figures like a Ben Franklin, George Washington, but I mean that we could legitimately find that there was a Bill Wilkins or any of these reported characters that would have made sense to have been there.
Yeah. Well, there were no historical characters. It was Wilkins' son, actually. I said Wilkins. He evidently did live in the house. Somebody called Bill Wilkinson lived in the house. And he did die there, evidently. And he went blind before he died. And all of this came out in the voices. But the trouble is, the voices also came out with a number of other aspects about him which were wrong. And also his character was evidently not the same sort of character that the original gentleman had. He was often referred to as Joe Wilkinson as well. So the first name got changed quite frequently.
If the girls could remember it or not, does that seem to fit?
Yes, it does. I mean, it was said, I mean, Margaret at one point said that Wilkins, because the names got changed backwards and forwards, died on a chair downstairs. I mean, I've got the quote in front of me from the tape 69, side B. And he did die in a chair downstairs, but that could have been spoken of by the family or something. There's another one here where one of them, the voice says, "When I was alive, I suffered from blindness. I never had a dog. I died from a hemorrhage. I'm Bill Wilkinson. I died 15 years ago. My wife died 4 years ago." But then the next minute, we have something completely different. So we have that... he was here a long time, had three children called Mandy, Wendy and George, aged 12, 14 and 18. And then it starts breaking into some fairly obscene language, etc., which I won't regale you with on the radio now.
And again, was this obscene language really out of character for the girls at that point? Do you think it was a shock grab?
The extent of it was. I mean, it was extremely X-rated in terms of its content. I mean, it's okay, children. I was a school teacher for some years, so I know that children can use bad language. But this was really heavyweight bad language, the sort of thing that you wouldn't expect children to be using, to the extent that it was, with many, many sexual connotations in it as well.
How did the researchers react when they would start speaking like that?
Yeah. they were really good. And this is not just Morris and Guy, but there were other people that came along as well. And they tried not to be shocked by it. They tried to just act in a perfectly sensible and reasonable way. And when the voices were talking about things of a sexual nature, they would answer them in a very adult and sensible way, which comes out on the tapes over and over again. You hear this awful stuff coming out, and then whoever's in the room at the time says, well, you know, I'd rather you didn't speak like that, but if you're going to, then I need to explain to you exactly what it is you're talking about. And they tried to get to be educational with it, if you like.
So that seemed to project as well that the remarks that were being made by children projecting this image, as opposed to an adult spirit who would know what it was that they were referring to.
Yes, indeed. I think that there was a mixture going on. I don't think it was one thing or the other, but a mixture of two identities almost sort of competing with each other. And one knew exactly what was what, and one didn't. And so those were slipping backwards and forwards.
I know that you want to leave the readers with the option for them to believe or not believe, to allow them to go in. And I know at the beginning of this, you said you came in believing this story was complete and utter rubbish. But once you finish listening to the hundreds of hours of audio, what are you really left with? Do you believe that there was a haunting that took place? Or do you believe that this was just a family that had been tormented, maybe dysfunctional and broken, and this was two girls acting out looking for attention that maybe they weren't getting at home?
Well done. I think you've given me all the answers, because I would say yes to all of that. I think that parts of it were certainly a couple of girls and boys as well, attention seeking, having some fun, and so on and so forth. But I also think that some of it was genuine poltergeist-type activity. I'm very loath to use words like haunting, because people immediately think of Hollywood, and I don't really want to do that. But I do think that there was some things going on there which were beyond our general understanding of life as we describe it at the moment.
Are you involved as an... as a researcher for the Society of Cyclical Research as well?
I am their liaison archivist. So I'm sort of in charge of the archive for this side of things before we then send it out to Cambridge University Library, which is where most of the archive is kept.
In being an archivist then, and having, I'm sure, listened and examined other cases, where do you feel that this fits in relevance to proof of psychical experiences?
I think that this is an extremely good case. I don't think we don't have on our records, and our records are extensive, a case that was as well investigated as this one by so many people over such a long period of time. So I think that this one stands out as being an extremely important case. If people think that it was all rubbish, then I suggest they listen to the hundreds of hours of tapes, and then they might change their minds a bit.
Well, I'm sure they'd love to, but as you said, they're owned by the society, who's not necessarily. Why do they hold back on some of this? I mean, if it's archival cassettes or recordings, and especially now that they've been digitized, why not just make them available for researchers across the world to examine and listen to?
Yes, I think they will. I mean, this is still fairly early days as far as them being finished. I mean, I handed over the finished copies to them literally only a few months ago. So I think it's early days, and I think in the fullness of time, they will be out there in the public domain for genuine researchers, I would hope.
Now, I understand this is a little hard, and the idea of this will be subjective to you, but knowing who is present, as I'm sure that Morris would have said, you know, Morris Gross, Janet, Guy, Playfair, about to discuss, blah, blah, blah. I'm sure there were introductions made that way. In recording these segments, were they ever looking for electronic voice phenomena, or was that not even really part of their research, aside from the DVP, the direct voice phenomena that was emanating from the girls?
Yes, absolutely yes to that question. There are plenty of times when Morris tried to instigate EVP, and he didn't really get too much joy with it. But on one occasion, for instance, here we are. I've just got the thing in front of me. Enfield statements for March and April 1978. And it says, once again, Morris Gross doing an EVP test. Knocks were heard. He heard knocking and scratching. And he repeated this on several occasions when he did various. There's another one just I've looked at here. When somebody turned up and they did an EVP test together. So certainly he tried EVP. He didn't get anything particularly of interest, so it wasn't successful in that way.
All right. I was going to say then, in reviewing the tapes all these years later and doing this, were there ever any audio artifacts that you uncovered that you're like, wow, everybody seems accounted for, but I'm hearing another voice?
Not really. Nothing that they didn't actually already draw attention to. There were times when they said, wow, did you hear that? And I thought, well, I didn't hear anything on the tape. But then it depends where the microphone was. And, I mean, if you have a room with a fairly basic tape recorder, they didn't have state-of-the-art machinery or anything. So therefore, it could be that something happened the other side of the room. They heard it, but the tape recorder didn't pick it up. I didn't hear anything on the tapes that made me think, wow, there's something there that they haven't heard that I've heard. And a few times they obviously heard things, and it wasn't just one person saying it. It would be several people saying, grief, yes, we just heard that, or whatever it was, that I didn't actually hear on the tapes.
And I guess in closing then, with this book out and available now, people having the chance to read this kind of unbiased version, just the direct quotes and stories that were told, what would you like to leave people with as an author and as somebody that put a lot of time and effort into this book?
Yeah. Well, I would like people to not, I mean, it says, I don't mind whether you've got a wide open or a closed mind, but I would like them to not have either of those two things. I would like them to approach the book and say to themselves, okay, let's try and go down the middle here and decide how much of this we think was genuine, how much of this we don't think was genuine, and then make a decision that doesn't exclude the fact that there could have been paranormal, in inverted commas, if you like, activity going on. I would hate to think people thought that it was all fake or that it was all the real thing, when in reality it was probably something down the middle.
Dr. Willen, thank you so much for your time today. It's been enlightening, and I can't wait to read the book myself. Again, The Enfield Poltergeist Tapes, the book is out and available. Dr. Melvin Willen, our guest, W-I-L-L-I-N. We'll have a link up to the book so that you can find it easily and conveniently on today's program. Thank you very much, Dr. Willen.
Thank you very much for talking to me. Thank you.
We'll be back again next weekend with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. And remember to check out our show this Tuesday, True Crime Tuesday. If you like our conversations about the strange and supernatural, you're going to love our True Crime Tuesday podcast. If you haven't heard it yet, make sure you subscribe right now. For only $5 a month, it gives you access to 4 brand new episodes every month, plus archives going back 2 years. How many episodes do we have in total now, Tim? Do you know, as a ballpark?
113.
Is a ballpark, Tim. I asked not for an exact number. I want a ballpark. Ballpark 2,500, but actuality 113?
113, yeah.
Okay, 113 on the button. So there you go. For $5 a month, it gives you access to around 113 episodes of True Crime Talk Radio. Not only do we examine some of the most bizarre and unusual crimes, we also share with you some laugh riotous moments from Florida Man and his friends across the United States and around the world with dumb crimes, stupid criminals. $5 a month, $1.25 an episode for the 4 brand new episodes every month. And that gives you access to the last 2 years of the show and 113 episodes. So stop waiting. Make sure you subscribe. It helps to support this show and all the programs that we do. So go subscribe right now. You can find more information at darknessradio.com. We'll be back again next weekend with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. And remember to join me Monday through Friday for the best in anomalous talk radio on Midnight in the Desert. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. And this is Beyond the Darkness.